Robert Putnam wrote a classic book in the 1990s titled Bowling Alone that argued that America's civic life is on the wane. He's back with a new book that takes a look at an equally pressing concern, the challenge of upward mobility in a society increasingly divided between the haves and the have-nots. The way things shake out these days, kids at the top of the cycle are getting a bigger and bigger edge on those who aren't. In other words, there's a persistent opportunity gap plaguing the country. The key, he says, is getting to work now to save the American dream. Robert Putnam's latest book, out last year, is Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. The New York Times calls him the poet laureate of civil society. President Bill Clinton once invited him to Camp David for a chat. And Bob, welcome back to Up to Date. So good to have you.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's good to be with you.
Let me just start with a very blunt question, Bob. Is the American dream dead?
No, but it's important to be clear about what the American dream is and why it's in crisis. The American dream fundamentally is that how well you do in life should depend upon you and your hard work and your skills and your God-given talents, but shouldn't depend on what your parents did or didn't do. When the very first thing we Americans said to the world when we became an independent nation was that we believe that all men are created equal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, at that time we really meant all white men, and we meant men for sure. We didn't mean women, but the underlying idea, which is that we all ought to get a fair and decent start in life, is close to the core of what it means to be American. And if my book is right, that premise that everybody gets a decent shot at success in life, regardless of what their parents did or didn't do, that's less and less true in America.
You know, that's a crushing idea, Bob. That's not what America's supposed to be, as you're saying here.
No, and Americans have a lot of disagreements about how will you, whether everybody should be equal in the end. I mean, Americans actually are not rabid egalitarians in the sense that we want everybody to have the same outcome. But we are remarkably agreed. 95% of us agree that everybody ought to have the same starting chance. And that's why this is not a partisan issue. I've talked to, as you mentioned, I've talked to some political leaders of the Democrats. I've talked to, in the White House, actually, with George W. Bush about this. I've
Yes.
talked with Paul Ryan about it. I've talked with Barack Obama about it. I've talked to people on both sides of the aisle in Congress, and nobody says, it's just, who cares whether rich kids and poor kids have the same or different chances. Everybody thinks we ought to do something about it. If it's true, and that's what this book is designed to show, that it's increasingly true that there's a gap, a growing gap, in the opportunities available to kids from both sides, from each side of the tracks.
You know, you draw a distinction in this book between income inequality and opportunity inequality.
Right.
What do you mean by that?
Well, income inequality refers to the fact that, some people have higher incomes than others. Many Americans think that's really important to not have that get too out of whack. But Americans, compared to people in other countries, are not so upset about Bill Gates or Warren Buffett making a lot of money, because we figure, well, if everybody gets on the ladder at the same point, and if some people climb higher, that's because they're better climbers or because they work harder at climbing, on the assumption that we're all getting on the ladder at the same point. That's the issue about opportunity. Do we all have a, roughly speaking, equal starting point, and that Americans of all stripes have always agreed is important. And what this book says is that's less and less true. The starting point is less and less equal for kids.
Robert Putnam is my guest. His book, Our Kids, the American Dream in Crisis. How did you arrive at your premise for this book, Bob?
Well, I grew up in a small town in the Midwest in the 1950s.
And in Ohio.
In Ohio, right, a little town called Port Clinton, Ohio. And I came from a very modest background, and I wasn't very conscious of social class differences in my town. And as we started doing this book, we went back and we interviewed all of my classmates from the Port Clinton High School class of 1959, so I'm 75 years old, and we And we've all done remarkably well. 80% of us have done better than our parents did, and the kids from the wrong side of the tracks in Portland have done just about as well as the kids from the right side of the tracks. But when we went back to Portland at the beginning of this study and looked at the difference between rich kids and poor kids today in Port Clinton, they're living in different universes. Because part of Port Clinton has been very hard hit by the it's a classic Rust Belt story. So the factories that were employed, the parents of my classmates, the physical plants are still there, but they're, you know, ruins now surrounded by barbed wire fences. And so kids who are grown up in the working class in Port Clinton are, you know, just living in awful circumstances. But along the shore of Lake Erie there in Port Clinton, what's grown up along the shoreline is a big gated community about 20 miles long and about 150 yards deep. And the kids who live in that gated community, they're all million-dollar mansions, are living in just a completely different universe than the kids living on the other side of the road. You could drive down East Harbor Road in Port Clinton, my hometown, and if you look to the left toward the lake at those million-dollar mansions, the child poverty rate in that census tract is zero. There are no poor kids living there. But if you look just to the other side of the road at the dilapidated double wides and the shacks where other kids live, those kids on the two sides of the roads, very much unlike Port Clinton 30 or 40 years ago, are living in different universes and have completely different futures stretching ahead of them. The kids in the mansions, they've got a great future ahead of them, but the kids just on the other side of the road, you know, they're not going to go to college. They're not going to go to community college. They're going to live very desperate and unrewarding lives, and they know it, and they're really upset.
You know, I thought this was interesting coming from you. Again, you're a professor of public policy at Harvard, had so much success with your earlier book, Bowling Alone, and your other projects. You say in here that you didn't realize until you worked on this latest book just how tough things had gotten for poor kids to get ahead. Tell us about that. I mean, was there one stat or one individual or one observation that you came across that really sunk in with you?
Yeah, well, it was accumulation of them of kids that we met, poor kids that we met, and rich kids. Part of the book, as you know, a lot of it is based on national statistics, but part of the book was based on a series of interviews that my colleagues, especially a young woman named Jen Silva, and I did with interviews we did with rich kids and poor kids all across America, in Port Clinton and in Duluth, Minnesota, and in Orange County, California, and in Atlanta, Georgia, and all over the country, Philadelphia, and so on. And the stories life stories of these poor kids are just shattering. I have a granddaughter who's just now 22. She's just graduated from one of America's best colleges. She's a wonderful young woman, but there's another young woman that we met, also a granddaughter of Port Clinton, a woman we call Mary Sue, who, when she tells her life story, it just causes you to honestly break up. It was hard to write the story, and it's hard even to read the story. People tell me they can't finish the book without crying because this other young woman, Mary Sue, she grew up with her parents split up when she was five, and her dad hooked up with another woman who hit her, and Mary Sue herself was caught trafficking marijuana at 16, right, and she failed out of high school, and she's completely alone. And her latest boyfriend tells her he can get her a job working as a, quote, model, unquote, in Toledo. And if you think of the gap between my granddaughter Miriam, and the future that awaits her, and the future that awaits Mary Sue, I mean, no one can, I think, read these stories and not think, that's wrong.
You know, to what extent, Bob, do you think that America is aware of this issue?
Well, you know, I don't know. That's the point at the book when I say, you just quoted me, that until I did the research, I did not. I mean,
right,
I knew the statistics about poverty and all that, but I didn't realize face to face how great had grown the gaps. Because people who are now, you know, adults, people who are now in their 40s or 50s or especially in their 60s, we grew up in a very different America in which it was, there was not such a big class gap. And therefore, we imagine that, well, you know, if these poor kids just pulled up their socks and pulled up their bootstraps, they could get along just fine. But I think that's based on an older image. And I think lots of well-meaning adults now who are living comfortable lives, I don't mean they're wealthy, I'm not talking about the upper 1%, but people who are, you know, college graduates now really don't know, because the society has become so much more segregated in terms of social class that most of us know people who are living lives like us, and that means we just don't know how bad life has gotten down at the bottom of the hierarchy.
Robert Putnam is my guest. His latest book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. I should point out that Bob will be speaking at 6:30 on Wednesday evening at the Plaza branch of the Kansas City Public Library. You can grab a seat by RSVPing. Just go to kclibrary.org. How quickly has this change happened, Bob? Because based on your own upbringing in Ohio, it seems to have come on pretty darn quickly.
Yeah, it's basically all happened in the last, you know, 30 or 40 years, and it's accelerating, so it's happened even much more in the last 10 to 15 years. You know, I think it's going to take us time to turn it around. I think we can turn it around. And the book, much of the book tells the story of what life is like on the two sides of the divide in America today, and that's a kind of a downer. If you read that part of the book, you think, oh, my God, can't we find a happy book to read instead? But I'm actually more optimistic that we can fix this kind of problem because we have been here before. This is not the first time in American history, Steve, that America has been divided like this. The best example is the time at the turn of the from the 19th to the 20th century, the so-called Gilded Age. Then, as now, there was a huge gap between rich and poor. The gap between rich and poor then was as big as it ever would be until now. There was a big segregation in American society then and now in terms of, you know, where people lived. There was a great sense of political alienation then, a sense that the political parties were not helping us solve our problems. I don't know what life looks like in Kansas City, but certainly much of the country now, that feels to be about right, that the parties are not helping us. Maybe Kansas politics is working. I mean, maybe Missouri politics is working really well.
I wouldn't hold your breath over that one.
So there are a lot of parallels, high rates of immigration then and now. So, and you could be really pessimistic if you were around then at this growing gap, opportunity gap in America. And then in a short period of time, about 10, 15 years, America recognized the problem and fixed the problem. The first sign that we were recognizing the problem actually was a book written by a journalist called How the Other Half Lives. It's a really interesting book. It was just a book of photojournalism describing life in the tenement slums of the Lower East Side of Manhattan, meant to be read by the affluent folks on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. And basically, the author, a man named Jacob Riis, essentially was saying to the folks up on the Upper East Side, look, do you realize what life is like down there in the Bowery? And, you know, some of the rich folks said, yeah, not my problem. But some of them said, you know, I didn't realize that, and we've got to do something about that. There was a young, ambitious young politician involved in the story too, a guy named Teddy Roosevelt that you've heard about. Yeah. But a lot of things were done. But here's the one example I want to use because it's relevant to the part of the country that you're in and the part of the country I come from, that is the Midwest. In 1910, in towns and cities across the Midwest, in Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa and that general area, in response to this problem, the growing gap between rich and poor, Americans invented the high school. God did not invent the high school. Or if he did, this is how he did it.
Uh-huh.
In those small towns, by high school, I mean the first time in world history that any town, any place had said, all the kids in this town are going to get, just because they're kids here, a free 4 years of secondary education. It had never been done any place. It was not an easy sell. You had to convince the local, you know, banker and lawyer and rich farmer and so on, who had already sent they'd paid for private education for their kids, and their kids now were off in St. Louis or Kansas City making a lot of money. You had to convince them they should pay for other people's kids to get the same kind of high school education. And it worked. It was the best public policy decision America's ever made, because it did two things at once, Steve. First, it raised the whole level of productivity of the American economy so much that single decision to have universal high school free for all kids in America, that accounts for most of American economic growth throughout most of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, it leveled the playing field so that rich kids and poor kids all got a fair shot.
Well, I was going to say, education, Bob, is supposed to be the great leveler here.
Yep.
And that's always been the promise and the absolute promise of public education. What's happened to our system?
Well, what's happened is, it's, you know, it'd be easy to blame schools for this problem. And as I go around the country talking to people, everybody says, well, you know, that's a problem, but this is another case where the schools have failed us. And I think that's completely wrong. This is not now a problem that schools have caused, and I'm saying that as a short one-liner, but that's, the book shows in great detail. Schools, on average across America, narrow the opportunity gap. They don't narrow it enough, but most of these class differences that you see as kids, you know, try to make their way through school, most of them are coming from trends outside the school buildings. So when my grandchildren go to school, they bring in their backpacks, they bring their parents' aspirations, and they bring their trips to Paris, and they bring their all sorts of advantages that they have. They bring them into the school, and that helps all the kids in school. But across town, when poor kids go to school in their backpack, they bring gang violence and disarray at home, and, you know, psychological problems and drug problems and so on. Not necessarily that these kids did, but that's what they're bringing into the school. And so it is true that education has got to be part of the solution. That is right. But it's not true that the problem was caused by changes in our schools. It's been caused by changes in the broader society, which the kids bring into the school. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And well, speaking of solutions here, the obvious question is, what do we do about all this? You talk about expanded tax credits for the poor, greater access to quality daycare, and more money for community colleges, ideas that have been around for a little while. You also talk about expanding proven vocational programs that Governor Jay Nixon has pushed out here in Missouri. Are there one or two of these ideas that hold the most promise in your mind, Bob?
Yeah, I think of all, there are a lot of things we need. There are a lot of things we can do, and you've mentioned some important ones, and I appreciate your mentioning those. I think the most important single thing we could do is to offer universal, high-quality early childhood education.
Mm-hmm.
And by early childhood education, I mean 0 to 4. We have learned a ton in the last decade or two about how early the differences in child development can be seen and develop.
There are still some skeptics out there who say, you know, we haven't really seen the proof yet.
Oh, no. Actually, I'm going to try to summarize the pages and pages of the book here. But I think among the experts, it's pretty well agreed. Honestly, it is agreed that high quality early childhood education makes a proven difference. Now, I'm not talking about glorified babysitting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about programs that provide professionally trained educators to provide developmentally appropriate instruction to kids, to little kids, 0 to 4. And, you know, it's some of the best evidence, actually, is actually right out in your part of the country. The epicenter for some of the best early child education in America is actually Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hmm.
You know, now Oklahoma is a pretty red state,
right?
But they have, for whatever reason, folks in Oklahoma, and especially in Tulsa, have invested a lot of money in making sure that their kids there, poor kids there, get high quality early child education. There are similar programs in Boston and other, you know, other places that have been proven
right
to have a positive effect. So, and I think, you know, honestly, the way this change is going to happen, it's the changes the last time. Remember when we invented the high school, that idea did not come from Washington, and it certainly did not come from Harvard. It came from, you know, ordinary folks out in your part of the country trying to fix the problem there. What I'm trying to say is I've been traveling all around the country. This visit to Kansas City is merely the latest trip. I've spoken, oh, I don't know, probably 150 different towns and cities across America over the last year. And almost everywhere I go, there are good people in those communities who say, you're right, we've got a problem here. And we've got it right here in River City. We've got, I know, right here in Kansas City, we've got these problems.
Yeah.
And let's figure out what we can do here to begin to narrow the opportunity gap right here in Kansas City. And I'm hoping when I'm come out to talk with you guys that we'll have a chance to talk about what things could be done or maybe even are being done right now in Kansas City to narrow the opportunity gap. This is not something that is, you know, like rocket science. We know practical things that could be done. It's just a matter of, look, here's the key point. The title of my book is Our Kids.
Right.
And it comes from the fact that when I was growing up in Port Clinton in the 1950s, and my parents used the expression Our Kids, as in, you know, our kids need a swimming pool. We got to invest in a swimming pool for our
right.
kids.
Right.
They were not talking about my sister and me, and they were not talking about a swimming pool in our backyard.
They were talking about everybody.
They were talking about all the kids in town, exactly. And they
yeah.
were saying everybody in town should pay a little bit more in their, you know, in the for a bond issue to build a swimming pool at the high school. But the and our kids then in that America, our kids meant all the kids in town.
Mm-hmm.
But over the course of the last 30 or 40 years, across America, the meaning of our kids has shriveled. So if you talk to people now about our kids, they mean their own biological kids. And they, you know, if you talk to people in Port Clinton even about
right.
Mary Sue, this poor young woman that we met there, they say, well, you know, that's tough, poor Mary Sue, but she's not my kid. She's somebody else's kid. Let them worry about her. The crucial issue here, Steve, is that it's not a matter of exactly what policies would work. I can tell you 50 policies that would work. It is, do we want to do this? Do we care about other people's kids? And I'm trying to say, this is the point of my book and the point of my visit to Kansas City. We damn well, forgive me, we darn well ought to care about other people's kids because,
mm-hmm.
first of all, if these kids don't do well, it's going to hurt the whole American economy. It's going to cost the whole American economy, the best econometric estimate is $5 trillion if we don't invest adequately in these poor kids. So it's going to cost all of us, including my grandchildren are going to be living in a poorer America if we don't invest in these other
Bob, let me hop in here just to remind our listeners that this conversation Bob's going to have will be at 6:30 Wednesday at the Plaza Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library. More information, kclibrary.org. Bob, 30 seconds here. You spent some time consulting with people in very high places, including the last three presidents of this country. What's that like, having a conversation with the president?
Well, part of the time I say to myself, what am I doing here?
Yeah,
kid from Portland.
I can imagine.
But, you know, you probably can tell, Steve, I care about this issue a lot. And
mm-hmm.
so most of the time when I'm talking to them, I'm actually I want to convince them that this is a big deal.
Right.
And so I'm not so much focused on the glamour. It's only later that I think to myself, did I really say that to the President of the United States?
Bob Putman's latest book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Bob, it's always a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks a lot, Steve. Good to
you
talk
bet.
With you.
Take care, Bob.
Bye.